that we are united. We are all at one despite our differences.
It's important because it's a very visible sign of the friendship and, you know, the togetherness that we have all through the year, actually. But and it's such lovely hospitality.
For me, it's an opportunity to, I suppose, show solidarity with my Muslim sisters and also, as Pauline said, take part in this wonderful experience.
It's no coincidence that this gathering is taking place during Ramadan, one of the most revered periods in the Islamic calendar, a time not just for abstention and reflection, but to help those who are less fortunate.
Ramadan is a time when we're always thinking about our friends, our family, our neighbours, our community at large. And I think it's one of those moments when we can all gather together, especially after the last couple of years when we haven't been able to do that.
The street iftar party was first organised in June 2017, just days after the terror attack in the Finsbury Park area on Muslim worshippers during the month of Ramadan that cost one man his life and injured nine others. The public iftar was a way for communities to show solidarity and silence hatred with hope.
Tonight, we celebrate. We celebrate the achievements of the Muslim community in this area. We celebrate and thank them for all that they do, and we enjoy a wonderful iftar supper.
This is in memory of our beloved brother Makram Ali, who lost his life in this incident, unfortunately. And we are here. We want to have it every year to, you know, remember what's happened and try to bring communities together after what's happened. And this is the main idea, is to bring us together, to say to those who try to divide us and spread hatred, fear and division that you will not succeed. We are together and we will be always together. Islamophobia has no place in our society, and we should all fight it.
At a time of global disunity, one small corner of North London is showing there is another way. Amina Taylor, London.
The Journalists Union in Damascus organized a ceremony to pay tribute to journalists who were killed in battlefields while reporting on the years-long war on Syria. Officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, and employees of media outlets.
Syrian journalists had doubled the responsibility. They faced a ferocious war waged by huge media outlets on Syria. Journalists wrote their words in blood in respect of their job, homeland, and principles. We remain loyal to the blood of our martyrs.
It was unfortunately a long list of those who were killed, but a reminder of the sacrifices made for the sake of defending Syria. Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation, including one for Press TV correspondent Maya Nasser, who I proudly received it on behalf of his family.
This ceremony means a lot. It means that the martyrs are always remembered in the media outlets they work for. They sacrifice their lives for the sake of the country. We are proud of their sacrifices.
We used to miss him a lot, even when he was alive. He worked most of the time. After leaving for work for a whole month, we saw him once, and then he was killed. It's a nice gesture to honor him by the Journalists' Union.
Maya Nasser was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He was one of many journalists who was keen on being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. In Syria, tens of journalists fearlessly risked their lives, were injured or killed just to convey the truth amid a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Honoring those journalists underlines the crucial role the media plays in any war, especially nowadays. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. from the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now in Tehran, standing by the Chitgar River. When you live in a busy, crowded city like Tehran, then walking by this artificial river could be very enjoyable. Of course, nothing is like a natural scenery. It's been for a long time that I haven't had a tour to the beautiful nature of Iran, and honestly, I really miss those amazing sceneries. So, today I'm going to take a tour to Bandar-e-Mohshahr in southern Iran in order to visit the beautiful region of Khor-e-Musa. I'm sure you'll like it. Khor-e-Musa is one of the firths of the Persian Gulf. Khor, literally firth, means a long, narrow indentation of the seacoast. Khor-e-Musa is a triangular firth northwest of the Persian Gulf. Khor-e-Musa is 20 to 50 meters deep. However, its depth reaches 73 meters in some points. This depth has made it possible for the ships, weighing up to 70,000 tons, to easily move along this canal. Khor-e-Musa has small branches on its western side. The oil tankers which move toward Bandar-e-Imam Khomeini have to sail through Khor-e-Musa. This canal is one of the most important natural canals of Iran. North of this canal, there are Bandar-e-Imam Khomeini, Bandar-e-Mohshahr, Sarbandar, and Petrochemical Special Economic Zone of Mohshahr. I am now at Bandar-e-Mohshahr. The weather is pleasant, though a little bit humid. Khor-e-Musa is connected to the Persian Gulf, and I feel really excited to see it. Here's the magnificent Persian Gulf. The smell that comes from the Persian Gulf is the most pleasant scent I've ever experienced in whole of my life. Here we have the Persian Gulf and Khor-e-Musa. Let's get closer to the sea. Look, there are a lot of birds here. Actually, Khore Musa has a diverse flora and fauna. The fauna includes humpback dolphins, flamingos, crested terns, sternidaes, small crabs and fish of different types, as well as lots of beds of different types, which are hard to count. Because of its unique nature, Khore Musa is an ideal tourist attraction for nature lovers. Oh my God, look at there! Several dolphins are playing at a far distance. I have to ride in a boat in order to see them very well. You know, dolphins don't approach the seacoast. The reflection of the sun ray on the dolphin's skin makes you think that each time that one of them jumps out of the water, a piece of gold is jumping. Oh, I can't take my eyes off all the beauties of the Persian Gulf. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It was a hugely anticipated ceasefire followed by a truce coming after 7 years of the Saudi onslaught, the truce being 2 months in duration it was supposed to be. It was an opening for a political solution that seemed to have taken place, but Saudi Arabia could not keep its end of the bargain. After not opening Sana'a International Airport based on the ceasefire agreement and allowed to have one flight a week, but then it reneged on that also. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how this may spell the end of the Yemeni truce, and what chances there are for this truce to take shape in order to move into the political process. Well, let's find out more about what has occurred. Abdul Latif Shali is our correspondent who joins us from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. So what is the explanation that's been given at this point for this one flight a week, even for that to not happen?
Thank you so much. The Yemenis, since the beginning of this UN brokered truce, they have been knowing that the Saudi coalition will not commit or obey to the terms of the agreement. They said that the Saudi coalition is maybe trying to rearrange its ranks during this period of time, and they are now trying to just keep detaining the Yemeni fuel ships and also obstructing all the flights were supposed to be coming and getting out of Sana'a airport. Today, patients were in the airport in the morning and they were surprised that the Saudi coalition stopped this flight also, which is only one flight per week, and it's not even enough to help a few hundreds of people during the truce. Now it has passed almost 3 weeks and the Yemenis did not use the airport. It was supposed to be opened since the first day of the truce, according to the agreement. And unfortunately, Saudi Arabia is only doing everything to undermine the truce. The spokesman of the Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abu Salam, said earlier that the Saudi troops in Marib have conducted a few raids on the city and also have conducted a few military operations against the Yemeni army, but the Yemeni army did not do anything to save the agreement and also to make peace over the country. But unfortunately, the Saudis and all the troops inside the country are trying only to provoke the Yemeni army to launch further operations, whether inside the country or even against Saudi targets. But I believe if they kept just doing this and kept not obeying to the terms of the truce, the Yemeni army will absolutely launch operations, not even not only here and inside the country, but also against maybe Saudi targets, and also Emirati targets will be included in the coming attacks.
Okay, so two key questions before I let you go. First, did they say until further notice? Did they give a date of when the flights would resume? And second key question here, you talked about the reaction by the Yemeni government. They've come out and said they're going to target either UAE or continue with the war. How much time frame did they allow to pass before they started their military operations or restart their military operations?
You know, two fuel ships are still detained by Saudi Arabia. Sana'a Airport is not opened until the moment. 3 weeks have passed until the moment and nothing happened. So the truce is with no benefit for the Yemeni people. Why would the Yemeni people keep telling the Yemeni government, the National Salvation Government, to keep holding this truce? They will absolutely demand the Yemeni army, what they will demand the National Salvation Government to do something to provoke the Saudis or to stop the Saudis from detaining Yemeni oil vessels or opening Sana'a Airport. You know, the last attack against Aramco in Jeddah, that was what Yemenis believe that was the reason behind this truce. And if the Yemeni army have launched further attacks like that one in Jeddah, maybe also inside Emirati territories, this will push the kingdom and also the UAE to stop their war against the Yemeni people and lift the blockade. So now 3 weeks have passed and the truce is only for 2 months. So I don't know, maybe it will be for another week or 2 weeks until the Yemeni army say that the truce is with no benefit for the Yemeni people, and also that the Saudis and the Emiratis did not obey to the terms of the truce.
Thank you very much for that. That's Abdul Latif Al-Bushali, our correspondent there from Sana'a. Okay, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Hamza Karim is a Yemeni writer and activist who joins us from Toronto. Also joining us is Brian Terrell, a political commentator and peace activist who joins us from Molloy, Iowa, I believe.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, great. Welcome to you both. Hamza Karim, let me first start with you. What is going on? You have this indefinite postponement for the flights coming out of Sana'a International Airport, which is the first in 7 years. And you have what was supposed to have been a flight to take, not for recreational use, passengers who needed medical care. So now the permit has been refused to be issued, which is a violation of this two-month truce. Why do you think this has happened?
I truly believe that Saudi Arabia, they don't have serious intentions in committing to any peace, agreements, or even this truce that was supposed to last for 2 months. We've seen in the past, for the past 7 years, there have been some truces in place, but really Saudi Arabia wasn't serious about them. Now, what Saudi Arabia is saying is that the main reason that they haven't issued the permit is because, you know, they're asking that all the passports for the passengers should be issued from Aden, which is controlled by them. And then the second issue I think that they're having is that most of the passengers that want to leave Yemen are, you know, the war-wounded survivors. So, again, these are only excuses used by Saudi Arabia to continue blockading Yemen and increasing the suffering of Yemeni people. The truce for the past 3 weeks, we've seen, you know, military actions have been are still taking places in various provinces like Marib, Hajjah, and Saada. There have been over 100 violations since yesterday. The port, the Al-Hudaydah port, is not fully unblockaded. We have two oil ships that are still, you know, held by Saudis at Al-Hudaydah airport or Jizan port. They're held there, and they have over 10,000 tons of oil and gas that is really needed by Yemeni people to resume and live a normal life, needed by hospitals, needed by the cars, needed for transportation, needed by factories. So far, what we've seen is that Saudi Arabia really are not committed to the truce, or are not willing to go further to resume peace talks.
Brian Terrell, something's not making sense here. When you take a look at when the truce was announced, and, you know, it's not a truce that is the first time that was announced. You know, we've had truce announcements before, and we, you know, this was was followed by certain political steps also that we're going to get into in a bit. But we're having on multiple occasions Saudi-led coalition to have broken the truce. The airport, one instance, then you have the what we understand positions in Marib of the Yemeni armed forces who have been targeted. You have the I guess oil tankers that are being impounded, and it was announced on April the 2nd, and here we are. It's just a little over 3 weeks old. Why do you think Saudi Arabia is committing these violations?
Yeah, it's 3 weeks into this, and you know, we've said it over and over again for so many years that this is a human catastrophe. This is an emergency, and it ought to be dealt with as an emergency. And the situation now in Yemen with exacerbated by the war in Ukraine, which provides 40% of Yemeni wheat, and now the food prices, just since this war started, has gone up 150% in Yemen, where most people can't afford the food and couldn't afford the food to begin with. So no, there's not goodwill here, and there's not goodwill on the part of the United States either. President Biden, as a candidate, parroted what everybody else is saying about the disaster of the war in Yemen and how barbaric it is and how it has to stop, and pledged U.S. cooperation with the Saudi effort would end. And in the first year of the Biden presidency, more than $1 billion worth of missiles sold to the Saudis. Now we're also seeing, I'm really happy to see that there's now a new effort by some people in the U.S. Congress to make a War Powers Resolution Act to stop the United States from cooperating with the Saudis. And this is something that the Democrats have done before. When Trump was president, and knowing that Trump would veto such a bill, and he did when it was passed. And now the Democrats largely are not behind this, and I think it's because it will force Biden into a situation where he'd have to either pass or veto such a bill. So yeah, and what's happening at the airport is like the idea that because some of the passengers don't carry passports from the Aden government, which in almost any way you want to look at it, doesn't exist anymore. You know, right after the early this month, the President Hadi was dismissed or stepped down, replaced by a presidential leadership council. It's a government that doesn't really exist, and any kind of negotiations, any real negotiations, you know, with Yemen has to include the government that is actually in power, whether people like it or not. The Nasra government is the government of Yemen, and there can't be any resolution without recognizing that and recognizing their passports, being able to talk at high levels with them. It's absurd to think that any steps forward can be made without that.
All right. Well, let's since you mentioned the U.S. and at the end there you're talking about that presidential council, let's talk about the U.S. If we can, Hamza Karim. I'm looking at the statement made very recently by the U.S. President Joe Biden on this, of which he has said that he has welcomed the agreement, but he said the terms of the ceasefire was just the first step. Again, I'm looking to see where this went wrong. Do you think that there was any kind of pushback by the U.S., change of mind by the U.S., then relate to Saudi Arabia? Because we know that the U.S. is trying to, one way or another, whether Joe Biden likes it or not, trying to claw its way back into the Saudis' liking, based on some reports. Do you think maybe the U.S. instigated a change of mind on the part of Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely. I think, Saudi Arabia in this war, they haven't been really driving or leading this war. We all know that Saudi Arabia can't make any moves, especially like these big moves, without a green light from the U.S. administration. Now, if we all remember, this truce came after the attack that happened in Aramco in Jeddah. And we all know that back then and even now, U.S. cannot stand, seeing the gas prices going up and do nothing about it. The war in Ukraine right now is already driving the prices of gas up, and they can't take seeing the prices going even more. So I think there was some pressure on Saudi Arabia to really at least absorb some of the anger that is happening in the international community and inside Yemen because of this war, really rearrange themselves in Yemen and trying to get all the groups that are fighting for Saudi Arabia and UAE and U.S. together and really get their ducks in a row to go back to this war again. For me, I don't see U.S. really being very serious about stopping this war in Yemen. If they were very serious about it, they would have, stopped selling arms to Saudi Arabia. They would have really just stopped providing them with all the intelligence and the logistics to continue this war. But so far, we haven't seen any serious steps or taking place by the U.S. So definitely, U.S. is not happy and are not willing to really stop this war. We haven't seen any serious actions. So I definitely agree that since the beginning of this truce, Saudi Arabia and U.S. weren't serious. They were just trying to buy some time to get their ducks in a row, to rearrange themselves, and to go back into this war.
Okay, well, let's go through the motions here as to where this stood in terms of the presidential council, or excuse me, presidential leadership council, Brian Terrell. On April 7th, this was sworn in before the parliament in Aden. Okay, and there they announced that they were going to negotiate with the Ansarullah movement for a permanent ceasefire, which then we were looking at the two-month ceasefire that came into, or truce, that was announced. And then we went through that show about Hadi transferring powers to the council. Of course, many are deducting that the Saudi Crown Prince fired him pretty much. But then we're looking at the representation of power, where there's an equal distribution of power between the countries north and south. And then you have the council, which includes the prominent leader of the SDC, the Southern Transitional Council, supported by Saudi Arabia and also as coalition part of the UAE. I went through this in order to ask you whether there was a change of heart or something that did not now stand well with Saudi Arabia in terms of the composition of the leadership council or the way that this went down. What do you think?
No, I really don't know about that. I think what's interesting is the Hadi government was the reason that the justification that the Saudi Arabia gave to begin with to be in Yemen at all in the first place. So with that gone, it kind of takes the chair out from under the Saudis and their excuse. I think that there is a you know, there is a fear that the Saudis have and the United States has that peace might break out. And if this Presidential Leadership Council shows any promise of really negotiating, with the Houthi government and really coming to an end to this this war and this horrible starvation, that will be stopped. That will not be tolerated by the Saudis or the United States. This is a cash cow, and the rising of the gas prices, as our friend said, is a very big issue here. While the gas prices are going up, the profits for the oil companies are going up too. So the anger needs to be assuaged, but we don't want to start bringing the prices down either. You know, the planet is in really bad shape, and we're in danger of catastrophic climate change. And all this time, all these these months that should be used, the research, the resources that should be put into finding alternatives to fossil fuels, instead are going toward this war. And we're seeing in the United States the Biden administration is not only allowing for more permits to drill and to frack, to use U.S. Oil and gas to counteract what's being boycotted from with the Russians.
Right.
We're putting everything as being set back, and the world is being put. We need to do something very, very different.
Sure.
We need to do it quick. The people of Yemen are suffering, and they're dying now. And mass starvation is real. But the whole planet needs the Saudis and the United States and everybody, the Russians, to change its course.
Sure. Well, this Presidential Leadership Council, Hamza Karim, I'm curious as to whether this was going to work anyways. Because if you want to take a look at the way that the leadership was going to be, it was very murky as to what type of influence could the Saudi side have, when we know on the ground it is the Ansarullah currently and the Yemeni government who have the support from the people. I mean, who does Saudi Arabia have or can put in place there for any type of reconciliation to happen? That's always been a big question mark.
Yeah, just to give you a bit of background about this Presidential Leadership Council. So what Saudi Arabia did alongside with UAE, and backed by the U.S., of course, is trying to group all the groups in ground in Yemen that had problems and even fought and killed each other in the past. There are some groups who are aligned with the UAE. Some of them are aligned with Saudi Arabia. So what they tried to do is put all these groups together. Now, these groups, the members of these groups, they all have power in ground, except for the president of the Presidential Leadership Council. But so what they're trying to do is basically get all these groups together and make them sit down and really work as a team. But we've seen this for the past 7 years. This did not work. These groups, they fought with each other. They killed each other in Aden, in Marib, in Shabwa, in many provinces. But I think there is some kind of pressure now on them to come together and work under one leadership. But I don't think this is going to work because all these groups have their own agendas. They all have their own plans. They want to they want to control some certain areas in Yemen. And it's very hard to bring them all together under one umbrella and put to one leadership for them all. So in my opinion, I don't see this is working because, they all have different agendas. They all have different objectives. They all have different visions. And it's very hard to put them all together in one table.
Well, then what are we looking at, Brian Terrell, if this thing falls apart, which is unfortunately going in that direction? What type of direction is this thing going to go, which we're looking at the threat that the Ansarullah movement and the Yemeni government has made, is that they're going to again go through targeting Saudi Arabia and the UAE?
Yeah, that's it doesn't it doesn't look good. And this council, by the very fact that it was pretty much appointed and put in place by the Saudis, means it's going to fail. The Saudis do not hold the key to solving the problems of Yemen, and neither does the United States. I hate to see it. It looks, as our friend says, it seems inevitable that the Saudi military is going to react as militaries do and as governments do, and under the provocations that it's facing. And it's not going to go well for the people of Yemen either. Because the Saudi, the UAE, and the United States, and our different allies are definitely stronger than the Yemenis have proven themselves very bravely and very and used a lot of ingenuity with its limited weaponry, but in the end, by sheer firepower, this is not going to be a military solution. It's not going to be a military solution that's imposed by the United States or Saudi Arabia, and it's not going to be a military solution that comes out of the Ansarullah government either. The promise that this showed of a negotiated end to the war is, as it falls apart, is all the more bitter, because in the end, that's the only thing that's going to happen. Someday it's going to happen. And how many people are going to have to die before then? Because there isn't any solution. Nothing will happen unless there's really good faith efforts for all parties to sit down and negotiate an end. And we have not seen any goodwill on the part of the Saudi Arabia or U.S., the UAE, the other coalition partners. It doesn't look good for the near future. We have to. Our help has to be a little farther out, and our prayers are with the people of Yemen. And as an American, my apologies are just so heartfelt, and I feel so bad about what our government's been doing to the people of Yemen and people all over the world.
All right, we're going to end it there. We are fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist. Hamza Karim, thank you, Yemeni writer and activist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahweh and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
hot sands of desert, a hell for US. April is the 42nd anniversary of the U.S. military defeat in Tabaz Desert in central Iran. On 25th of April 1980, six U.S. aircraft and eight helicopters of the U.S. Army invaded the Iranian airspace in what they claimed to free 53 hostages in Tehran, who had been detained back in 1979 in the U.S. embassy, which was in fact a den of spying against the nascent Islamic Republic of Iran. On 4th of November 1979, a special team called Delta Force was formed to attack Iran and take the hostages out of the country. The operation, codenamed Operation Eagle Claw, was indeed launched for overthrowing the Islamic Republic system of government and finishing off the newfound Islamic Revolution. The operation was conducted with the flight of a number of aircraft and helicopters from an aircraft carrier ship in the region. Operation Eagle Claw failed from the onset due to technical problems in one of the helicopters 120 kilometers away from Ravar, a city in Kerman province, and the helicopter was forced to land and the crew were transferred to another helicopter. But the second helicopter also faced technical problems and returned to the ship. Thus, the remaining six aircraft and six helicopters reached Tabaz Desert in central Iran and landed in the dark of night in a remote place untraced by radar systems. In this phase of the operation, one of the helicopters faced technical problems whilst fueling. Therefore, three helicopters were useless before the start of the main phase of the operation. Due to these events, the US president at the time, Jimmy Carter, ordered the forces to stop the operation and to return to the ship. But this was not the end of the U.S. adventurism in the Tabaz Desert. Operation Eagle Claw caused a big scandal for the U.S. as the aircraft and helicopters faced a very horrendous sandstorm the moment they wanted to fly. Consequently, a C-130 Hercules aircraft and a CH-53 helicopter crashed and were set ablaze. As a result, eight invading forces were scorched and four helicopters were too damaged to fly. The remaining criminal forces flew on board the five remaining aircraft and landed on USS warship Nimitz. The U.S. Special Forces had earlier been sent to Arizona to simulate the operation under harsh conditions as the region and climate in Arizona resembled those of the Tabaz Desert in Iran. Operation Eagle Claw turned into a real hell for the criminal invading American forces, and the operation was an absolute debacle for the United States. As the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, said after the event, "The sands of desert were the agents of God." The fiasco in the central desert of Iran was a serious lesson for U.S. officials and the U.S. military, yet they were not admonished and continued their hostility against the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. hostility against Iran has continued ever since, and currently it is in the form of forging fear of Iran or Iranophobia in the world, especially regional countries. However, former U.S. President Donald Trump confessed that the United States had not gained anything in spite of spending $7 trillion in the West Asia region. The Arab analyst and editor of Ra'y al-Yom newspaper, Abdul Bari Atwan, said the American army failed to stay in Iraq for more than a few years. It sustained over 3,500 dead and 30,000 injured and spent $6 trillion. For the past decade or so, the U.S. regime has left no stone unturned to forge sedition and chaos in Iran. The climax of these efforts was in the elections of 2009 in Iran, where the U.S. strove to put in effect the scheme of soft overthrowing of the Islamic system via a velvet revolution. But, thanks to God Almighty, the United States has failed time and again due to divine help, prudence and insight of the leader of the Islamic Republic and the Iranian people's vigilance. The United States has always tried to exploit every opportunity and incident to foment anti-Iran sentiments throughout the world. Once it resorted to blatant terrorist activity, such as the assassination of top Iranian Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the international figure of resistance, to quote the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's naming of this brave commander of the IRGC Quds Force, or even the coronavirus outbreak. Yet, it is Iran that has emerged powerful, unlike the United States, which is getting weaker and weaker. The U.S. humiliating debacle in the Tabas Desert in 1980 didn't end its conspiracies against the Islamic Republic. U.S. politicians have incessantly hatched plots and been engaged in sabotage activity against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Since the very beginning of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the United States made public its plots with maximum pressure. Washington has resorted to various types of sedition and destructive measures, including military intervention, coup d'etats, supporting the former Iraqi dictator Saddam in an all-out war against the Islamic Republic, causing insecurity inside Iran through supporting various terrorist groups active in the region. The aim of the United States in these years has been focused on besmirching the image of Iran in the region and beyond, and throwing doubt on its supportive and advisory role among the regional countries. In continuation its hostile activities against Iran, the United States put the name of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC, in the list of terrorist groups. This while the IRGC has always been at the forefront of battling various terrorist outfits, like Daesh terrorists, the Al-Nusra Front and so on, and has been the support of the Iranian and regional nations to defend their security. The United States assassinated the top Iranian general, the head of the IRGC Quds Force, Qasem Soleimani, on 3rd of January 2020. In response to this dastardly act, the IRGC targeted and smashed a U.S. military base at Ain al-Assad in the Al-Anbar province in western Iraq on 8th of January 2020. This was a big slap in the face of the United States. Iran has always stressed that it will not initiate any war, but it will make any aggressor and initiator of war regret its actions. The expansion and bolstering of the missile program in Iran is in line with the same strategy. Major General Mohammad Bagheri, the chief of staff of the Iranian armed forces, made it clear that there is no doubt in the issue of expansion of the country's missile power, and this progress should be in a way that, in case of clash with the enemy, we won't let them endanger our aerial sovereignty, and that the Air Force will carry out its operation and support the air and naval forces closely. Washington, continuing its provocative activities, let one of its spying drones invade Iran airspace in June of 2018. However, this drone was shot and downed by a missile fired by the IRGC Aerospace Force. The U.S. state-run television channel CNN wrote on its website, "The Americans learned one of their most admonishing lessons at 22,000 feet. It reiterated in a report by Nick Walsh that this event is considered an obvious sign of strengthening of Iran's military abilities." Jeremy Binney, an analyst of West Asia and North Africa region, said, "This event shows well that when Iranians really invest on something, it can be really counted upon. We knew this about their ballistic missile capabilities, but it seems that Iran's air attack system is exactly the same." The US regime has also tried to isolate Iran and to coerce it into negotiations. So it took every measure to intensify political and economic pressure on Tehran. But Iran is not a weak country in the region or the world. Insistence with this behavior indicates that the United States continues to live in a whimsical world and continues with its wish of four decades ago when it pursued military invasion of Iran and breach of Iran's aerial sovereignty and adventurism in the Tabas Desert. Today, U.S. politicians and officials resort to rhetoric, media ballyhoo, and psychological operations to pretend that they're dominant over everything, whereas discourse leads to a dead end. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on the occasion of the birth anniversary of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, "The enemies of dear Iran have enforced different kinds of political, economic, and propaganda pressure against this nation, but they have failed to do a damn thing even during the days when the Islamic Republic was a fledgling state."